For SearchSecurity.com, I'm Bill Brenner. You're listening to a special edition of Security Wire Weekly. Security luminary Dan Geer is most famous for being fired by At Stake 5 years ago for co-writing a paper warning that a Microsoft monoculture threatened national security. But most forget he was also part of the Athena project at MIT during the creation of the Kerberos Authentication Protocol, which today is incorporated into a variety of products, including Sun Microsystems' Solaris operating system, Microsoft Windows, and various Linux installations. I recently sat down with Geer to talk about the history of the protocol and to ask him about where the technology is headed in the future. We'll be back after this.
You may not know it yet, but integration is the future. A recent TechTarget survey of nearly 1,000 IT professionals revealed that the integration of network and security operations centers has clearly become a top priority for most organizations. Thankfully, the latest lesson from SearchSecurity.com's Integration of Networking and Security School offers an inside look at the processes involved with merging network and security operations. Learn how SIEMs can enable better enterprise policy enforcement, how to deal with skeptical executives, and much more. Check out this networking security integration lesson and many others at searchsecurity.com/netsec. That's searchsecurity.com/netsec.
You are one of the people who were there at the beginning via Project Athena, and so I'm wondering if we could start with you kind of giving an overview of what your role was and what kind of, what some of the thought processes were in the conception of Kerberos.
In other words, how did this start, so to speak?
Exactly.
Well, I think you know that Kerberos was an implementation of an already thought-out protocol. What is known as a Needham and Schroeder. Needham, R-N-E-E-D-H-A-M, Roger Needham. And Schroeder, S-C-H-R-O-E-D-E-R, Mike Schroeder. I actually think Needham is deceased, but I'm not certain of that. He was in Cambridge, England. Schroeder was on the West Coast. I haven't talked to him in some years. He worked for Digital, which of course doesn't exist now. Compaq and now HP no doubt did not throw away the fabulous research facilities that Digital had in the Palo Alto area, but I don't know where Schroeder is now either. But the two of them, whom, to be honest, I barely know, and it had nothing to do with this, had written a paper. And the paper was in 1978 in the communications of the ACM. And I can dig up the reference if you like, but I'm sure you've got it or it's readily at hand, in which they talked about how to achieve authentication in an open network. At the time, the word open network meant available to eavesdroppers. You know, words change over time. I'm sure you are bedeviled by that in your line of work.
Yeah.
But the phrase open network at the time was the opposite of closed, or what we might say today, instead of closed, we might say black. But the issue was that how can two parties establish that each is who the other one says it is in the face of a connection mechanism that had no guarantees other than delivery? And going back even further, TCP/IP, of course, doesn't do anything but guarantee delivery. In fact, does the phrase end-to-end mean anything to you?
Yes.
Okay. The end-to-end idea, the argument for end-to-end, which is Salter, Clark, and somebody or other, was an early decision about the Internet as we knew it. And it said that roughly for the Internet, of course they weren't speaking of the Internet as we know it today, but for the Internet to be maximally useful, it should have one duty only, and that is transport. And so you had the choice of datagrams, UDP, you know, single packet, if it gets there, swell, stuff. It doesn't. That's how it works. Versus TCP, which guaranteed delivery, and so forth. And this end-to-end argument was that the network only had one duty, and that was delivery. And it didn't have the duty, for example, of confidentiality or integrity or anything else. That if you wanted those features, build them into your protocol. And one of the things that distinguished the MIT crowd from, say, the Carnegie Mellon crowd or the AT&T Bell Labs crowd was that at MIT we were serious about the end-to-end argument. And as such, almost everything we did involved thinking carefully about what kind of protocol you wanted to design to do it. And Kerberos was, in other words, a designed protocol to meet the theoretic advantages of the Needham-Schroeder design.
Mm-hmm.
Other places, take Carnegie Mellon, for example, wanted a much higher level service as the basic building block. Instead of just best effort transport, which is what we stood on top of, they decided that a fully distributed file system with everything built into it was the answer. You wanted to print on a remote printer, you wrote to a certain directory that happened to be owned by the remote printer and it printed for you. Or you wanted to send email. That was a file transfer between one part of a large file system to another part of a large file system, and so forth. In other words, instead of living in a transport medium, you were living in a file system. And the Andrew project at Carnegie Mellon went that way, and it did lots of wonderful things. The so-called Andrew file system, or AFS, which was, by the way, later integrated with Kerberos, is an absolutely wonderful thing. I have no problem with that. I, like most of the MIT crowd, were hardcore protocol people.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes to Kerberos, what we did was we wrote a protocol. These days, as you know, everybody embeds things on top of HTML, or HTTP rather, and they just figure out how to carry it. And it's not as if people design protocols anymore much. And that's okay. I mean, I'm not being a curmudgeonly old timer. In my day, we walked 7 miles to school both ways uphill. You know, it's not, I don't mean that at all. But I just mean that there was a difference of opinion, a strong difference of opinion, which has since been overwhelmed by mass adoption of, no offense to anyone, lower skilled or work products of other people. Now, the Kerberos protocol, again, goes back to Needham and Schroeder. And the advantage of Needham and Schroeder, by the way, is although they didn't have this proof at the time, some other people came along later, Burroughs and Abadi and Lampson, and again, I can give you all these references you want, but they developed a way to prove whether an authentication protocol actually worked or not. And as you might guess, it's a little math and some set theory and so forth, right? And for what it's worth, Needham Schroeder is a proved protocol. So for the purpose of this discussion, one of the advantages of Kerberos is that the semantics of what is going on have been proved to be correct. And not everybody can say that by a long shot. Now, mind you, cryptographers and crypto-mathematicians and people like that, when they say proof, they mean a level of proof that isn't ordinarily of interest to a business, say. You know, it's the academic level of proof. But it is nice to know that Kerberos protocol is, if implemented correctly, which is always the little asterisk off in the corner, is proved correct. Now, what happened was that Jerry Salzer, who was a professor at MIT, double E guy, sort of well known for lots of things, including Multics. Not the only person who developed Multics, of course, but out of Multics came Unix at Bell Labs. I suspect you know that history.
Oh, yes.
Jerry, along with Dave Clark, and I'm sorry I'm forgetting who the third one was, had come up with this end-to-end argument, which won the day in the early design of the ARPANET, which became the Internet. Steve Kent, who was at BBNN and is still there now, came up with the argument that that the end-to-end thought led naturally to security was also end-to-end. And then we had Needham and Schroeder happened to be Salter's graduate student at one point. And he had gone on to a worthwhile academic career and wrote a paper with Needham, and that's 1978. Now, we're talking, when I arrived at Athena, which was sometime in 1985, I suspect in the fall, I'd have to look that up. Anyway, 1985. Athena had been going on for a little while, but had yet to, you know, show much. And I was, for what it is worth, hired as the head of system development there. The titles we used were manager as opposed to vice president, as opposed to supreme commander, as opposed to whatever. So I was a manager of system development. There was also a manager of application development. And Athena, do you know the history of Athena at all?
I do.
You know how it came to be?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Salzer had been brought in a little bit after the fact to impose some order on all of this. You know, a fully tenured faculty member had no real duties beyond teaching the occasional course, was a big system builder, thought would be good, and he was good. He was a difficult man to work for, and I say that both with scars and with some praise at, you know, what I learned from him. You know, I'm sure you've worked for people who are just simply difficult, but you learn stuff.
Yeah.
And Salzer was like that. One day he came in my office, took his arm, and literally swept everything on the top of the desk onto the floor and said, "We need to start over." You know, that kind of thing. He had jettisoned one project that was everybody's near and dear to their heart, which was roughly reinventing NFS. And he had declared we were going to do some other things, like implementing the Needham-Schroeder protocol. And I was brought in at about the time all the proverbial, you know what, hit the fan. That is to say, Jerry's not a manager, he's a leader or a dictator. And he was jacked up one level, and I was inserted between him and all the staff. So now I got all his flack, but the staff got some direction. And so everything done at Athena that you know about was done by my staff on my watch. I was there 5 years. The people who worked on Kerberos itself included people who did work for me, notably Don Davis and Ted Cho and Ken Rayburn.
Mm-hmm.
And one who didn't work for me, which was Jeff Schiller. Athena had been created to do educational applications, but it turned out fairly quickly that the faculty was uninterested unless it was reliable, and unless the students didn't have to learn a whole new everything for every class. If you had to use a different editor for chemistry as you did for math, as you did for literature, who cares? That will never happen. If you could use one editor, if you could, sure, you can have choices of them, but the fact is that you could do your work, regardless of the course you were in, with reasonably similar facilities, and by God, they were always available. And that was the hard part, because nobody had dealt with that before. Everybody had done demonstration projects, and if you've ever hung around the media lab, you know that once the demo tape is cut, they're done. Well, this was the opposite. We didn't do demo tapes. We did real implementations. Now, this was, I think now, let me think about that now, the fall of 87? The fall of 87 is when we went live with lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, the first workstations were big and clunky and, by modern standards, nearly useless, but, you know, we've all lived through, I can't believe I used to work on that and thought it was cool. We've all lived through that, and it was that kind of thing. We had moved from about 80 VAC 750 timesharing machines to starting to put out, as we called them, clusters of workstations, and it was at that point, which I believe was fall of 87, but I can find out if you want for sure, that, for example, Kerberos went live. And by going live, I meant that there were things you could not do unless you could present over the network Kerberos credentials.
Let's talk about the evolution of Kerberos into the internet as we know it today and how people do business on the internet and where you see the technology going as we wade deeper into the Web 2.0 universe where everybody is doing everything online, especially in terms of commerce. Do you think that it's evolved well with the internet and people's use of it, or are there areas where you see need for changes?
Well, you know, if Kerberos ends up, I'm going to use a word that's inappropriate, but I don't know what else to use. If Kerberos ends up being defeated, it won't be because someone broke it. In the way a cryptographer means break it, you know, that they figured out how to subvert it. It won't
right.
be that. It'll be more like the business model that it supports is no longer relevant. If the person presenting the credentials is themselves unwittingly compromised. Yes, the credentials are good. The protocol worked. Everything that it can prove has been proven, except that the thing that you wanted it to prove may no longer be true because the other person may be no longer under their own control, but they may be under the control of somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's a hard problem. But that isn't the problem we set out to solve, and it isn't a problem that's solvable in the sense of there's no protocol that solves that. That is an endpoint problem.
That'll do it for this edition. Remember that you can catch all the latest security news as it breaks on our news page at searchsecurity.com/news. And you can also see our list of podcasts at searchsecurity.com/podcasts. Again, I'm Bill Brenner. As always, thanks for listening.